Welcome back to Lightning Session 3, ladies and gentle beings. Meine Daseinsformen und Menschen, vielen Dank. There were still so many people who still wanted to do a lightning talk that we decided to do another one. And since we're already late, we will immediately start. Is the first speaker here? There was someone... Oh yeah, all right. Let's see, I also have my little list. Lightning talk schedule day 3. Okay, so you are X socks about the bug bounty friends. Cool. Then the stage is yours. Go, there's a microphone.
Thank you. I will be referring to my phone for notes, so please bear with me. Hello, I would like to introduce you all beautiful beings to the concept of bug bounty triage. Now, okay, who knows what bug bounty is? Like, we have some hands that are not raised, so I'll give you the too long, didn't read, didn't listen. It's basically outsourcing your software bug hunting to outside beings and paying them as long as they stay within your guidelines. A lot of corps basically rely on bigger platforms to do the signing up processes, etc., rules for you. And, you know, basic goal is to improve security, and it often does. Often. So triage part is basically what I'm working with right now. It's the customer support, sort of, portion of bug bounty. I'm the lady behind the counter that bug hunters submit their reports to, basically. And I take a look at the report and I categorize it by, is this valid in the first place? Is this going to the right place? And is this the right sort of severity for what has been submitted? And a lot of those are fields basically submitted by the hackers themselves, like this is going to such and such domain. I merely need to check whether that is within our scope, within the rule set of, yes, we will accept these sorts of reports and we will pay for them, or if I need to politely tell them to please like submit this to another sort of program, which is also within scope, but may not be paid, like with monetary benefits, etc. Because we want all the bugs, we just might not be able to compensate for all of them. I happen to work for a big company with a lot of small moving parts. So, for scoping, easy. Domain goes into scope, and scope also consists of what you have done. So phishing employees for credentials does not count as a bug report. I'm sorry to tell anybody who may have had the right idea to do that. And these are like things that we have ruled out as like we do not need these sorts of reports in order to encourage people to not try to hack us, just find bugs that we can use to improve our security overall. And in terms of severity, now here's the difficult part. Determining severity is very particular to the company and the dev team. So I basically need to take a look and just glance over the report and see if, okay, so this has been submitted as like an exceptional bug. Does it count as an exceptional on corporate level? Does it affect an exceptional number of employees, for example? Does it take exceptionally little effort to be vulnerable to this? Such as SQL injections. Long story short, worst case scenario, you can expose like the entire database. That is an except. Well, that is a critical at minimum. It might be exceptional. We have our corporate criteria with that. And after I have like initially like glanced over, seeing if it's the right sort of severity, I let the hacker know that yes, we will pass this on or submit it elsewhere. And then I go to the dev team and I'm like, hey, we have such and such report. Do you think this rating matches? And the dev team is usually, yeah, okay. If it's a critical, they'll be like, oh shoot, we need to take a look at this right away to determine whether we need to fix it now or if we can like take a short breath, like calm down. It's not that critical. And usually the dev teams are either in agreeance or consider the reported issue to be lower than initially submitted. Very rarely does severity get like upgraded from the initial like submission. It can happen. It has happened. And sometimes my intuition, like, I go to the dev team and be like, okay, so we have this medium bug. It looks like a low to me. And they're like, no, that's okay. It's a medium. And I'm like, really? I don't have to, like, ask for reasonings for it staying medium, so don't ask, don't tell sort of deal. But usually for lowering severities, we like to give hackers reasons for lowering stuff. Sorry. So in terms of initially, like, when I got to this job, I hadn't done any bug bounty, like submissions, triaging at all. How do you determine what is what? We have like a small guideline of such is such, like open redirects. You plug in a URL and then slash, I don't know, google.com, and then suddenly that URL directs to google.com. We consider, in my like line of work, those as low. And I know this because we have like a small list of guidelines that appear on our bug hunting platform as well. And using those and consulting with colleagues who have also done this before, I hate to say this, but there's like no general rules. You just sort of get an intuition for it. And if I had any slides, this is the part where I'd have the image of that guy in the Matrix movie being like blonde, brunette, etc., etc. You just sort of get a feeling for it. So in terms of, in case any of you guys are interested in starting submissions, I have some helpful guidelines to make my job a little bit easier for like determining, triaging what sort of report you've submitted. So POC, proof of concept, basically, reproduction steps. We love those. We like those. Sometimes it just needs to be a link where the bug is shown to the person judging it. And sometimes it needs to have images. We love videos. Saves us a lot of work. Sometimes like submissions are made in a hurry, such as this one. And that's understandable. Like bug bounties are sometimes a rat race of who finds the first bug and who submits it, and the rest are categorized as, hey, we've already gotten this before, so we won't pay you. Unfortunate. I always hate giving the news. So we understand that there might be details lacking. Just be ready to provide anything in case the triager asks. And just closing out, if you're wondering whether you should submit a bug report, yes, always. Like, three bug reports that are not in scope, not on the right domain, not even belonging to our corporations. We don't care, we're just happy to have submissions. It keeps me busy, and we would rather have all the false positives instead of one false negative. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Next one on my list. Asbjørn?
Yep.
All right. Oh, for those of you who are annoyed by getting rickrolled by the stereo device, we have a headphone station where you can directly get the audio from stage streamed to your headphones. You want the dark one? It will be bad on this.
Let me take the dark one. I make both so we could choose. It's exactly the same. Okay, you have the keys and the mouse.
Yep.
The microphone.
Yep. There you go. 10 minutes.
Yep. Hello. I'll talk about some of my pains with libvirt and what I've done to solve it. So libvirt has this kind of dialogue with the in Word Manager at least, where you can select a few different network types, and it has bridge and Mac VTAP device and NAT and so on. It has also a few others that you can select if you're going to create a new network concept in it, but I don't really want to use that. I'd rather have it with a specific network interface per virtual machine and not all this bridging bullshit thing. So in order to accomplish that, I found this metadata field in the XML that is already used for OS information, but that can also be used for a lot of other stuff. And as long as you have a XML namespace, it's possible to just make an extension and then use a hook to get called once the virtual machine is getting started up, and when the tap device has been defined, and then by using a lot of XPath queries, it's possible to pass this XML in a shell script in a more sane way than regexes, and then by using this information about the configuration, you can configure the forwarding of the network stack in a way that doesn't involve this bridges and other weird stuff. So it looks like this XML. So this is the metadata part of it. It's split up so that it fits better on the slides. And basically it's just, you can have multiple interfaces. You just have to specify the MAC address of the interface so it knows which interface, which gateway belongs to. And the gateway node in this XML is just directly transferred over to IP address add command. And the host is just transferred to a route. And it's also possible to add router so that you can route a subject into a virtual machine. But by doing it in this way, then you also end up using this special type Ethernet interface, where instead of this normal thing, it's called network or something like that. But then it has this bridge type elements under it, and here it just has the most basic nodes underneath the interface element. But the important thing is to change it to type Ethernet, and then take the MAC address from there and use it in this XML. And then it ends up just creating it as one the same subnet you can have on multiple different virtual machines. But then you have a /32 device route, which means that it knows that that is the most specific route for that IP address, and therefore it only asks for ARP on that address. And then by also using reverse route filtering, it also ensures that it's only that interface that's allowed to use that address. So it would block traffic if some other virtual machines try to claim an address that doesn't have permissions for. And then you can also have inter VM reachability, even if they're on two different VM hosts. If you have these /32s propagated through some routing daemon like BERT or free range routing or whatever you want to use as routing daemon. And then we also use the proxy app. The machines can see each other even though that they are in two separate layer twos. Then it's possible for them to reach each other because the proxy app means that that when the VM host sees the ARP request for IP addresses, that it knows that it has a better route to on another interface, then it just claims to be that address, and then the traffic gets routed between them. And some of the future stuff left for this is some stuff like trying to get Word install to make this custom XML metadata. It has some options for them, but there are quite a lot of options you need to add and a bit cumbersome to do. But it would be nice to have some wrapper for that. And it would also be nice to have a Word manager integration so that it's more user friendly. But Word Manager is a little bit difficult in that it has no way of detecting which hooks are installed on the server. So, and I know there's no options to set that this server has these extra capabilities. So that part is missing in Word Manager, and therefore that's a bigger task. And otherwise, try and check it out. It's a small, easily readable shell script, easily split up into a lot of different sub-functions to keep it nice and tidy. And yeah, I've originally prepared this for a 5-minute slot at BornHack a week ago, but yeah.
All right, thank you very much. All right, you posted an address. If you can't see it here, remember the stream is recorded. You can just check out the video later and type in the address. Our next speaker is Astro, right? All right, welcome.
In browser, good.
Hello. Hello, I'm Astro. I really like decentralized technology and I really enjoy social networking. So even back then I used Identica and Diaspora and I hacked on Buddy Cloud. And we asked ourselves, how would global discovery work in decentralized social networking? And it didn't take us long. We just looked at the open web and there are search engines which fulfill this task and everyone uses them, right? So I've been using Mastodon for like 5 years now, and last year it really took up, and we decided to open our own very small instance. And when I migrated from Chaos Social to our own 10-user server, I felt pretty much left out, because there's no big federated timeline. Hashtag search gets less useful. And we spent some thought on it and took a look at the Mastodon API, whatever Mastodon already offers. And it didn't take us long to write a little spider that just crossed Mastodon instances. And then we just counted hashtags and created a site called fedi.bus. And you can even filter by language. And if you look at the German language, can I zoom? There's the CCC camp trending. Oh, it was 5 minutes ago. Mastodon is very active. So you can see whatever is trending now. In the left column, you can see what is trending in the last 4 hours. In the middle column, what is trending in the last 24 hours. And in the right column, what is trending in the last week compared to the last month. And it's pretty full of soccer. So that was very entertaining to build. And of course, we don't get your private messages. We see even less than Google sees. And we store no content data. We only count hashtags. But of course, we want to use proper Mastodon. We don't want to watch there. We want to use the hashtag search. And once we ran our own instance, we discovered the admin settings in Mastodon. And Mastodon intends to integrate so-called activity pub relays that allow you to swap all the content with other instances. But if we use this content from thousands of Mastodon servers, our Mastodon server will be pretty overwhelmed. That's why you can find at the bottom of this page the link to a very specialized relay, the Fedibus relay. And that contains some little instructions, and then you can add a so-called activity pub relay by hashtag. For example, okay. If you want to subscribe to hashtag CCCcamp23, that's the URL you have to put into the Mastodon relay settings, and then you will get lots of specific interesting content to your Mastodon instance. As it turns out, this can also be used by ordinary users, but it's actually intended for Mastodon admins. And in the meanwhile, we started this like 9 months ago. There's like 1,500 individual subscribers. So people really like it, and they find it useful, and it enhances their Mastodon experience greatly. But the Mastodon developers decided to shut down the APIs for use. I don't know why. So that brings us problems. In fact, they didn't precisely shut down the API. They made it authentication only, so only their registered users can get the public timeline, which is public data. So if you go back to my Fedibus, to the main page, you can you can hit the link up in the right corner, and there you can enter your Mastodon instance and donate an API token for us, so we still can consume the public federated timeline. Nothing of your private messages, but please let me add, don't use Mastodon for private messaging. It is really not end-to-end encrypted, and it's not properly separated from the activity pub part, which is about publishing. So your direct messages in Mastodon will be directed statuses. It's not end-to-end encrypted at all. So have fun following hashtags, and if you want, please support the service.
Thanks a lot. And thank you for the tip with direct messages. I was actually also not aware of that. Cool. We're getting along. The next speaker is Pierre. Is he here? Oh, yeah. All right, there you go. 10 minutes.
Hi, everyone. I'd like to present Scouting.app. It's a mobile-first app to organize a secure, transparent election. So it's a tool to organize a digital election. How does that compare with physical election? Because we want all the useful properties of a physical real election. What do we actually want? We want our votes to remain confidential at all costs. That's one of the main priority. And we also want the execution of the election to remain fully auditable and transparent. And we want the result to be proven correct, so no one can really contest the result at the end of the election. So cryptographers and researchers invented the concept of end-to-end verifiable election to do exactly that. So in this kind of system, your vote, you can verify that your vote had been accounted for, so that your voice has been heard in the election. And you can also verify that the election, like the result of the election, is actually the result of all the encrypted votes. So how does that work? We use, so your vote is encrypted, and we use homomorphic encryption to tally all the votes together, and then only the result is encrypted. So along with every vote, because it's encrypted, we to ensure it's a valid vote, there is some zero knowledge proof to verify that you only vote, for example, for one candidate, and you only add one voice and not more. This kind of system can also use MixNet as an alternative or complementary to homomorphic encryption. So MixNet acts as a ballot box. Basically, the votes can be mixed, so you cannot know who has voted what, and then you just decrypt all the votes, but you don't know from whom it's from. It's like really like a ballot box. To do that, we use the excellent Belenius library from IRIA, which is formally verified, and do all the as all those great cryptographic operation. Check it out if you're interested. On top of that, Scoot&Op app is compatible with decentralized storage and decentralized authentication. That means that entities that don't trust each other can still co-organize an election and don't have to fully manage all the voting lists. They can manage all the voters separately, but still make consensus over the result of the election. We think these tools can have great potential to make voting much easier, cheaper, and accessible, and we can organize a lot more of election and polls to have a lot more democratic tools. And you can also use a more complex voting scheme, like Condorcet and candidate ranking. So you can have some rules that maybe be more fair and have more chance to do consensus than just voting for one candidate. You can make something more complicated because the machine will compute the result, so you don't have to do it manually. Roadmap. We have a demo you can check out, but we only have a basic implementation with basic voting system, and we want to implement alternative voting like Condorcet. And also this decentralized identity, because authentication is a big part of making sure everyone only voted once. So that's a big part of online voting systems.
Cool. Thank you very much.